This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey everybody, I've got a little bit of housekeeping here before we get into the episode about Instagram and Theology Beer Camp. So I've been getting more active on Instagram, and I just want to let you guys know, in case you want to see me make some videos where I look directly into the camera, I'm sharing some stories and posts about basically all the topics that we cover on this show over at instagram.com/DanKoke. That's C-O-K-E, and the link is in the show notes. Also, Theology Beer Camp is returning in 2024, October 17th through 19th. The theme is Return of the God Pods. That is a Lord of the Rings reference, which should surprise nobody. I will be there alongside Brian McLaren, Diana Butler-Bass, The New Evangelicals, Bible for Normal People, Tony and Josh from GGCH, of course, Trip Fuller and Homebrewed Christianity, and a whole grip of others. And you can use the promo code RETURNOFYHP, all one word, for $25 off your ticket. Prices go up starting June 1st. That link will be in the notes. I hope to see a bunch of you guys there in October. It was a serious highlight of last year for me.
My name is Dan Koch. Like many of you, I've been on a complicated faith journey for a number of years now. And while I tend to find myself on the progressive side of Christianity, my goal is not to make liberal converts. I want this show to be a resource for Christians to my right and to my left, as well as former Christians and non-religious folks, anyone who finds themselves asking difficult questions about God, science, prayer, fate, suffering, evangelism, and more. So many of us have been given bad answers to those good questions, often by people with pure intentions. I want to say that you have permission to take both Christianity and the modern world very seriously. And I hope to facilitate that by introducing you to people seeking God across the Christian spectrum, engaging hard questions in a multitude of ways. Thanks for listening.
All right, Kristen Tideman, thank you for joining me to kind of debrief this shorter episode, this listener question answer around wrathful God passages in the Bible and how I approach them or find value in them. So people will have already heard that episode. You've watched it a couple times, Kristen, and had a chance to reflect on it. And I'm curious kind of how it hit you or what you're curious about.
Yeah, well, those visuals in YouTube, you're like, whoa, I can see it all right in front of me. A little scene from The Tree of Life. Love that film. Uh-huh. Classic. So, yeah, it was good. Really, you know, really brings it to the next level. It's a great question. It is a good question. You said that right away. And I have reasons I'm interested in it. Like, if I were to be someone who had listeners with a question like that, but you were immediately interested, and I was curious why it was so intriguing to you.
Yeah, that's a good place to start. So you know, because you helped craft the email that went out to my email list, and we asked people for questions, which we do probably a couple times a year. We ask listeners or patrons or email list people or whoever, patrons, I mean, members of the Patreon campaign for your permission. We ask people, like, what are some questions you're kicking around? We like to know what people are asking. I love it as a format to sort of kind of speak directly to whatever's going on for people. That's a real reason for me to do the show in general. And in this case, we asked about kind of barriers to faith, and we got a bunch of great ones. We're going to be responding to a number of these questions. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if we got up to 8 to 10 of them in the next 6-8 months here. And I think what I connected with immediately was I have been going through pretty fertile, like a lot of growth, a lot of movement on how I am making sense of being a Christian despite not being able to hold the kind of, you know, a more robust, more kind of authoritative understandings of the Bible, more historical understandings of the stories in the Bible, you know, kind of being unmoored from that more traditional, more conservative way of doing things, which I have been disconnected from that for like a decade plus now. But in the last year or so, I've had many experiences of kind of getting interested again, getting curious again, finding myself kind of less triggered, for lack of a better term, by more traditional understandings or readings or interpretations, whether that be in church or in a video or on an episode of someone else's show or something like that. So I think I just was like, oh, cool. This is a fun one to jump in on. And I immediately had, like, my brain just kind of started answering it. And I started writing notes like as soon as I had read it. And so, and then within like 24 hours, I had sent like the first half of the video to you and Sari and Josh. And and so I think you were like, whoa, Dan had a lot of fire for this one. And I think that, that's basically why.
It's cool to hear. And so just to recap, people probably listen, but it's again, a listener that wrote, they've maybe kind of gone away from Christianity. They're coming back. They're looking for ways to engage. And I bring that word out because I thought that was interesting. I'm sure we'll get back to that. Engage with the biblical texts, maybe kind of in a new way. But it's hard when there's all these passages that seem to depict a very wrathful God. So mainly around this wrathful God idea.
And especially what they made a difference, a distinction in the question between intrinsic punishment and extrinsic punishment.
Yes.
Intrinsic punishment, I have no problem with, nor does the question asker. Like, if I act like an idiot, if I am a dick or an asshole or selfish or whatever, like, I'm going to reap what I sow to some degree in my life, right? That, like, the punishment for my actions is in some sense contained within the actions, and I will then experience them in my life.
Well, almost the little boy who cried wolf, you know?
Yeah, sure. Like one of those. But but then extrinsic punishment is like, no, God is displeased and God then punishes in some specific way. And what the listener, what the question asker, really, we should have asked for at least like first and last initials. They're all anonymous. I'm going to have to like make up names for these people. Oh, well, that's inside baseball. What the asker mentioned was the Bible is full of examples of extrinsic punishment of God directly. You know, God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. God sent the flood. God did all these things directly to punish people. And what the listener was like, look, I don't think that God does that. I still want to engage with the Bible in a meaningful way. Dan, how do you engage with these passages? That was the question.
Right away, you kind of get into this distinction between taking something at like kind of the truth value and then this potential metaphorical reading.
Yeah.
Now you're saying, when you mentioned that you're moving away from like maybe the more traditional view, and I would say that's a view of inerrancy when approaching biblical texts, that they are infallible, there's nothing that can be wrong with them.
Right.
Once you've taken that step, a lot of things change. And I would say, yeah, you're saying, okay, so we don't have to take this punishment thing as just because it says it, that's exactly how God is. However, I would say what I was wondering is I conversed with Sari about this a bit.
Oh, good.
Is it within the mind of, like, as a psychologist, just someone who does therapy, what does it mean that someone would write that then? Like, the writer, the author of that, you know, you're saying they're meaning making, but what does it mean that they're making meaning about a wrathful God?
Yeah, I would say in that case, specifically, that if God exists, God must be like X. Fill that in however you want. In this case, it's God must sort of send in extrinsic punishment to kind of let God's creatures know what they're doing wrong. You know, this is all over the story of the Israelites, that yeah. like God and the Israelites are kind of in this constant back and forth, and God has opinions, right? Mm-hmm. And has preferences, and Israel doesn't always live up to them. Now, again, not a biblical scholar, not an ancient anthropologist, but my understanding is that everybody would have thought that back then. Mm-hmm. Like non-monotheists would have thought that about their, what we would say, like small g gods, right? Mm-hmm. The Israelites would have thought that about Yahweh. Early, like proto-Israelites who weren't quite monotheists yet, who had Yahweh, but they also had Baal and other gods, they all would have thought that these gods are like active in the world. You think about the story of, I can't remember which Old Testament prophet it is, but he does a showdown with one of Baal's prophets. Do you know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. And they like put the altars up and they say, call down fire. And Baal doesn't yeah. do anything. And Yahweh does. And like,
I think it was either Elijah or Elisha.
Yeah. One of them, right. Elijah or Elisha. So mm-hmm. that story is interesting. And we could talk about sort of the poetic value of that story and what mm-hmm. that story is saying about God. In this case, though, the assumption that a God who really existed would be perfectly capable and perfectly willing and interested in sending fire on this altar at these GPS coordinates at this time to show the human beings who are within eyesight and to tell generation to generation afterward to show them that Yahweh's real and that Baal is full of shit, right? Like nowadays we think, okay, you know, when they were living, they had what people call a three-tiered cosmos sense of the mm-hmm. world. There was the earth and the heavens above, and then the underworld below. There was no space. There was mm-hmm. no solar system, other galaxies. So, you know, thinking as a person in 2024, like I got to think, okay, do I think that in the year, whatever, 850 BC, that the God of the universe was like, yes, it's important that these 100 people gathered here, see me throw fire down on this altar and prove my supremacy over Baal. Like, I don't know about that. That's a harder for me to affirm, but it would have been very easy for someone to affirm back then. So in that, it's a kind of a long-winded way of saying, what does it mean that this is the meaning that they made? I think it's not surprising. The assumptions they had about a wrathful God would have been totally uncontroversial in their mm-hmm. time. What mm-hmm. then becomes interesting is, what do they do with these concepts about God or gods that everybody would have had? How are the biblical authors actually challenging some of those assumptions and coming up with visions of God that are, from my perspective, expansive, that challenge the Israelites to like think beyond themselves, that, you know, stories like Jonah, which is my favorite story in the Old Testament mm-hmm. of like, yeah, even the Ninevites, even their animals matter to God and they're yeah. your enemies. Right. So all that kind of thing. Am I getting at that question?
It's not for the true statement of, you know, this is exactly how God is, but it may be the true statement of this is how I, the writer of this passage, perceive God in my time and in this time of, you know, cultural difference and whatnot. There's a lot of things in what you said that are kind of implied. And I think the fact that we've been trained to read the Bible as an inerrant, infallible, you know, the inerrant, infallible word of God is one of them. So learning to approach it differently is,
yeah.
I mean, I have the same thing. It's not like
and
you
it
just
takes time. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not like you change that. And I would say that's yeah. something where when I hear someone say engage, when I think of, you know, Lectio Divino, doing my devotions, how are you listening mm-hmm. to God? What does that mean?
How's your time in the Word been, Kristen?
Exactly.
Yeah, engage.
Oh my
yeah.
goodness. We had a woman, I have a twin sister, you know this, but we had a woman at my church when I was in high school, and she approached my sister at one point and she's like, so who's closer to God? Whose devotionals are better? Yours or your sister's?
Between the twins?
We were like, can you imagine?
That's the funniest twin question I've ever heard anybody ask. That's great. Like, that's golden.
As if you don't compare yourselves enough, now yeah. you have to see who's closer to God.
Now
but
you
anyway.
Think on a spiritual eternal ledger, who comes out, you know? Yeah.
You know what's hilarious? Great. I think she said me, and I was like, yeah, it's me.
Oh, you didn't say her? That would be you're both really humble. So you both agreed that you were closer to God, which might mean that you weren't, right?
Well, I think at that point I was taking more time to do my devotionals, but look who's the missionary now. And, she's the missionary.
Now she's far closer to God than you. Yeah. You're playing catch up. here.
Yeah, I'm talking to you.
You're talking to me. But you're like talking to a heretic about other ways. You know, I mean, obviously she's much closer to God. So
we'll go run and tell the lady from church. But yeah, so
give
I
her an
say,
update. Yeah.
Give, hey, later. Guess what? Yeah. Where were we? Like, yeah, the kind of truth statement. So learning to do that differently, like taking off this very set way of approaching the text that has been solidified through evangelical history, not through all of history, it is challenging. And in a way, a lot of what I'm hearing you say is really putting on a historical lens. And you kind of have like a particular hermeneutic in allowing for it even to be metaphorical in instances that I'm sure some people will say, oh, well, this book, you know, Song of Songs is metaphorical. This is, you know, a book of poetry.
Yeah,
or
that
whatever.
Idea is more controversial in some parts of the Bible than other parts of the Bible, right? I think a lot of people, even conservatives, would say about Jonah, for instance, it's not that he actually was in a big fish. That's not the point here. This is like a moral tale that tells us something about God. Other people would say, no, like Nineveh was real, so this is real. I mean, I'm saying, you know, conservatives would disagree with each other. But some of them would even be open to a more metaphorical, like, this is the meaning that they were trying to make. This is the meaning they're trying to tell us. They're trying to contrast a view of God with another view of God. And that's really what the biblical authors intended, not to be telling a historical tale. Job, right? A lot of people don't think Job is a, even conservatives don't think Job is a literal story. But I am going a step further. I'm acknowledging that I'm saying, no, probably like most original hearers and most Christians over time would have taken these wrathful God passages as historically accurate and and actually characterologically accurate, we might say, like accurately describing God's character. And, you know, what I didn't do in the video, and I don't think we need to do it here either, is sort of motivate why somebody would be dissatisfied with a more traditional take. Just to say the listener is dissatisfied. I agree. I'm dissatisfied with that traditional take. And so what's another way of doing this? And this is one of the ways is to use this meaning-making lens and think, well, what did it probably mean to them then? What did it probably mean to people who heard it originally? And also we say written, but these would have been oral traditions for a while in that culture. And then what, and even like talking about the Jamaicans, you know, in the 70s and talking about the way that these words are reinterpreted, what has it meant to other groups in other times, if applicable? I think that can be a really rich, like a really rich ground to till and find stuff in these in this wisdom tradition that has lasted for, you know, coming up on 3,000 years for a lot of this exile stuff.
So the other thing I noticed you doing is really an exercise in philosophizing in terms of taking the existential weight of living and saying we engage with this by making meaning. And that's not something everyone would ascribe to either. Some people would, and maybe there's a specific kind of approach even on the therapist side that you're kind of modeled or something. Maybe you could speak to that. But I would say, you know, when I first actually started having these thoughts, and I would say in college of like, oh, this stuff doesn't really make sense. For me, the instinct is not immediately to go to like existentialism, let's make meaning. It was more to go to nihilism. Well, if there isn't this inherent meaning to be found, not made, then it all seems very fabricated. And that doesn't seem worthwhile to me. Now, I'm not saying I'd still necessarily go that direction. But what is important for like you in saying we should maintain this wisdom tradition, and this is an important meaning-making way, why not also then turn to other meaning-making ways? You know, I would say, I don't want to go all Rust Cole and True Detective Season 1, but like,
please.
He's the nihilist living that out. How do we...
Until maybe the end.
Until
maybe
the end.
He's not.
Sorry, so what do you, well, yeah, it was like kind of a lot of questions there, but what do you think of that?
What you're making me think of is there are actually kind of two, maybe not two different ways of talking about meaning making, but two different applications of it. There is kind of the more quotidian, everyday, straightforward sense that I don't think anybody would really disagree with. And that is to say, like, okay, so let's say your grandfather has recently passed away and you tell a friend like, yeah, he actually wrote out letters for each of his grandkids individually. and mentioned things about us that he loved and like what he hoped for us as we got older. Now, yeah. Let's say I ended up at, you know, your mom's, your grandpa's estate sale, and yeah. I found that letter and he didn't send it. So I read it and it's like, well, let's say I don't know you. Okay. So it's just like I find a random letter from grandpa to random grandkid. Now I will find some meaning in that. I could sit there and go, wow, what a sweet man. Like what a loving and intentional man that he did this before he passed. But if it's my grandpa writing the letter to me, the difference in the meaning is massive. Right. It's not just, oh, there once was a kind man. It's my grandpa who shares my DNA, who gave birth to my mother or father or whatever. I didn't give birth to them, but you know, whatever.
Well, like relational history.
Yeah, exactly. And all the memories I have from being a kid sitting on his lap or, you know, whatever it is. So the idea here is that I don't think is controversial. The meaning is not like inherent in the words because someone else can read the words and they will go, that's cool. That's really sweet. Mm-hmm. But if it's your grandpa, then the meaning your mind creates more meaning than just the semantic meaning of the sentences, right? Mm-hmm. Because you connect it to your story and your memories and your love for your grandfather. So that's a basic sense in which we make meaning. And I don't think anybody really, that's not really controversial.
Yeah.
Understood that way. The second one where you're kind of getting more into existential philosophy, this is the idea that in existential philosophy and existential psychology, we recognize that because meaning is created by people. Now, a true existentialist, so to speak, will say that's the only meaning there is. It is all created. There's no inherent meaning in the world. A Christian existentialist would probably, like myself, would probably disagree with that and would say, no, it's not that there's no inherent meaning, but rather that for whatever reasons, the God who created the universe made it such that, or allowed it to be such that, we co-create meaning in a very serious and significant way. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that the universe is meaningless. Yeah. I believe that there is intentionality on the part of God to have creatures that can make meaning, frankly, is a pretty good way of saying it. So that's the larger sense of making meaning. And that so then I might kind of differ with some existentialists, and I also might differ with more conservative Christians where I'm like, no, we are actually pretty involved in making the meaning here. It is not just the Bible has a meaning and it's my job to discover the Bible's meaning and then follow those orders, which would be a more traditional sense.
Yeah.
Did that answer your question?
I think so. Yeah. I guess, you know, if you kind of make the shift from, okay, I have to take this for the very apparent meaning of like the wrathful God, and I can move away from that. I almost want to say, why not just move away from it? You know, like what? And maybe it's just that easy. And I would say that opens up, you know, and you, I know you're a great reader as well. Like you find deep meaning in a lot of written works, a lot of books.
I'm such a great reader. That's what everybody says about me.
He's got a great reading record.
By the way, though, major nosedive once grad school started. and I'm just very slowly kind of trying to get those muscles back of reading regularly, like reading fiction and all the stuff that fills me up. Not such a great reader the last 5 years, but I have read fairly widely, I would say.
You got a good collection. You got some decent classics.
I'm a nerd.
Steinbeck. So maybe making it just personal, what compels you to continue to search the biblical texts for
that? Why not just ignore it and go, all right, peace later, Bible. The short version is that even as I have moved further away from more traditional reading, used the fancy word hermeneutic earlier, right? My sort of lens through which to interpret the text. Even as I've moved away from that, my appreciation for what I would call wisdom literature has grown. And so that would include the Judeo-Christian tradition, but also other religious traditions. The difference being that I'm not embedded within those other traditions. So I might actually, you know, probably these days I would objectively value the biblical text similarly to something like the Bhagavad Gita or the Tao Te Ching or something like that. That's going to make some people feel uncomfortable. I'm not a Taoist. I'm not a Buddhist or Hindu.
Not yet. No.
Not yet, I guess. And, you know, there's interesting questions around, like, some people have multiple religious identity. I talked about that a little bit with Josh Patterson on an episode that will probably will air after this, I think. You know, but that's not me currently. I don't currently identify as having multiple religious identities, just Christianity.
Simply Christian.
Simply Christian. I live a Christian life. And I go to church and I take the Eucharist and I pray Christian prayers and I try and model my ethical life on the Sermon on the Mount. I engage in conversations on this podcast and other places in my life with fellow Christians. It is encouraging for me to do so. And it continues to be pretty fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's kind of important if I'm going to keep doing that to have some way of engaging the Bible. Otherwise, like what I think the listener is getting at is like, keep rubbing up against this thing, which then stalls me out on something I might want to be doing with my faith. And so it's important to have an off ramp, you know, have another road that one can take without just going, well, I guess we'll just ignore all of that because we can't read it the same way we used to. Right. Yeah. So that's the motivation for me mainly.
Do you think there's a way, like, say enough people kind of get in this boat of like, okay, we are seeing this more historically and not, you know, in this inerrancy lens. Do you think there's a way people could kind of turn the ship towards like, okay, we acknowledge that the people writing this had a big impact on what they interpreted God to be doing. Mm-hmm. And now we see that as, you know, as with things even like slavery, you know, there's different mentions of that throughout the Bible. And obviously that's
slavery is a really good reason to take a view of the text more like the view I take. Yeah. Otherwise, you've got some issues with all these biblical writers seemingly assuming that slavery is fine. Just be like a good slave master. Just be like a really good slave. That's basically Peter in the New Testament.
You can get your freedom, go for it, but you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So like that's where kind of the morality of those biblical authors, like, I think really fails. Mm-hmm. And I would rather have a view that says, no, God has never been a fan of slavery under any circumstances. People did not believe that they could live without it. People didn't have a category for living without slavery, but now we do have that category. And would God want us to lean
and
into?
Now it's called a 9-to-5 job. No, I'm just kidding. That's not insensitive.
We got the anarcho socialism has entered the chat. you know, but of course that is different than, you know, true chattel slavery.
Yes. Oh, yes.
You know, and even whatever forms of slightly different slavery may have been acknowledged in the Bible. I mean, certainly there was tons of chattel slavery in the ancient world and, you know, pyramids and the Roman Empire and, you know, slaves have had a real shitty go of it in human history. So that's a reason to have a view like I'm describing and like the listener is describing, as opposed to having to twist yourself in knots over why God would have possibly just been like cool with slavery and then less cool with it. And then, you know, over like a couple thousand years in a universe that is 13 billion years old on a planet that's 4.5 billion years old, it just gets weird that God would change in 1,000 years or 100 years. It's like, probably God's the same and we're changing. That seems a lot simpler to me.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that actually comes to mind as you're saying this is a little bit of when Saul was made king and God was kind of like, you don't need a king, but you really want one. So here you go.
And that's that would actually probably be the counter argument to what I'm saying. If I was going to steel man it is like God isn't changing, but the text changes because God is accommodating people. Now, on that view, you would still have something like what is called a progressive revelation, where God is giving kind of better and clearer visions of the good, of love over time. Functionally, that ends you in a similar kind of spot, right? Because you're still then thinking, well, then what's the next one? Can we get even closer? If the abolition of slavery is a genuine moral improvement in God's eyes, if the inclusion of women is a genuine moral improvement, then we aren't just looking backward. We're looking forward. And I would say that's the same. That's my view of morality, is that there will be things that my grandkids think are obvious that are more morally beautiful that I don't see or think are obvious. Mm-hmm. I don't know which ones those are going to be. And that's the challenge,
yeah.
Because there are a lot of people will put forward a lot of options for the way that they think that they can future-proof their morality, yeah, and ethics and be on the right side of history. But there's also been, yeah, people who tried to do that and then they got it wrong.
Yeah.
You know, I think, for instance, of the blank slate movement in psychology, or maybe popular psychology, of like, mm-hmm, you know, what we really need to be progressive is to assume that children are born as a totally blank slate and society itself can fully give them better and better moral senses and ethical senses. And that just seems to not be true. With 50 years of, mm-hmm, better epidemiological research, better genetic research, better psychological research, twin studies, things like that, that kind of give us a look into, yeah, exactly, that, yeah, give us a look into the way that we are actually kind of born, what we're born with and what we learn, you know, our nature and our nurture. And these tabula rasa blank slate approaches have been quite discredited. At the time, many people would have thought this is the way to future proof. Mm-hmm. This is the way to stay on the progressive edge of our moral vision of the world. So there can be wrong turns amongst well-meaning, yeah, progressives as well. And it's difficult to predict which ones those are going to be. That's kind of the limitation, yeah, of living in a yeah, singular time and place.
Yeah. And I mean, while I would say I'm probably quite similar to you, and like, I mean, probably a lot of views and pretty progressive, and seeing that, you know, how things have changed even within, you know, my lifetime, or between even me and my younger sister, who's not that much younger.
Right.
Something that comes to mind in this is a little bit of like the cognitive science of religion, some of the work on how kind of moral standards have changed culturally, and not just that they get more progressive, they just change, like disgust mechanisms change.
Yeah.
Some historically there's just bigger emphasis. I wish I could remember more of them, but there's like sometimes a much stronger emphasis on just different aspects of what is moral. And like right now, one of the biggest, the worst thing you can do is hurt someone else in our society. And that's not always been the case. And is, right, that just because we're better, or is it, you know, a lot of times there's things that are different. I mean, and I think that's a conversation that I'm maybe not trained enough to have in its entirety.
That's a tough one.
But,
and who's got, yeah, and who's got the pay grade to talk about, you know, what a future, more beautiful, more complete morality will look like. I mean, mm-hmm, we can disagree about that, but I love people who try to answer that question. That's a beautiful question, yeah, to try and answer.
Yeah. And I would say I remain curious of how much of we equate morality with like purity in the way of like, oh, well, someone who's bad, you don't associate with them. And I think that's something that has now, in my view, that is not a way to live, where you just can't associate with people who are doing things that they shouldn't be doing. In fact, because that doesn't lead to restoration. Mm. And so I'm kind of, and I would,
but
that's
say in all over the Hebrew Bible. I mean, all,
yeah,
the stuff about Canaanites,
true,
is all about like non-miscegenation, essentially. Don't, yeah, mix ethnicities, but especially don't mix religions.
Yeah. Although it's funny, like welcome the alien. So at the same,
right,
on the same token. There,
exactly. So there's a push and pull. I mean, my favorite, yeah, thing to say about the Bible is that it is multivocal. It has multiple voices with multiple, not totally overlapping visions of God, visions of morality, visions of ethics. And it's a push and pull. It's a tension. And, yeah, it's probably one of the things that makes, I mean, this is a little off the cuff, I'd want to think about this, but I wouldn't be surprised if one of the things that makes, for instance, the Torah, the first five books of the Hebrew Bible, so long lasting as a piece of literature is the way that it does contain competing visions and holds them in tension like a real group of people is.
Yeah, yeah.
Like that maps, mm-hmm, much closer onto an actual nation of people than a book that's like, well, here's the perspective. It's just this one.
Yeah.
Get in line, or, right, you're out to pasture. Like real people are more complex. Real communities are more complex. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. There could be something to that too.
Wow. Well, I don't know. That feels like a good place to stop for me.
Inspiring place to end. Yeah.
Nice tidy end.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it, Kristen. Thanks for bringing some really good questions and kind of follow-ups and all that stuff. It's fun.
Yeah. Thanks for diving into the wrath stuff.
Love dealing with that wrath.
All righty. Wow. Well, talk to you Wednesday, Dan.
Okay. I'll see you for our weekly meeting.